session number 4808, reel 4.
Mr. Golding, reel 4.
We were lucky in one respect as far as our health and disease was concerned, that I never once ran into a camp where there were any cholera epidemics. And I think this is the main difference why our death toll was very much less than those who worked on the railway up in Burma, that those people ran into cholera belts. And if you run into cholera, well, that's it, because I believe even in the best of conditions it's quite difficult to cure cholera, certainly, and there's no treatment at all. They were very lucky, though I did meet later on, when we had moved to Singapore, two or three survivors of cholera who were all right, except they had to wear very tightly laced waistcoats because they'd lost all the muscular strength in their bodies around the rib cage.
Whilst you were in camps like Tanjung Priok, was there any problem in keeping yourself amused? Did you suffer from boredom?
Strangely enough, it's a bit like if you're in hospital, I suppose. You always think you're going to be terribly bored, but somehow time passes. We should have been very much more bored than we were. Certainly we worked quite hard, and I suppose in a sense the ever-present threat of beatings and so on stopped you being as bored as you might be. And also, of course, when you're right down to it, that are you going to wake up next morning, and in fact consciously being aware that when you wake up in the morning, oh good, I've woken up, I'm still alive, that gives you quite a different perspective. In terms of straight entertainment, we did have a few books knocking around the place, and you were carrying a library. One of the dangers about books was, though, that books contain paper, and paper's greatest value was smoking paper, because there was no shortage of tobacco in the East Indies. Tobacco is an indigenous plant around there, and so we could always get all the tobacco we wanted, and pretty tough stuff it was, black most of it, but the thing was how to smoke it. And alas and alack, I think most of us preferred smoking the Bible to reading it. And we worked our way through. There was also, interestingly enough, a superb example which somebody ought to produce today of how inflation can become absolutely rampant, which it was there, because the Japanese paid out in their own currency. I mean, I don't mean in yen, I mean they just printed occupation money, which, so they would have a piece of paper which had printed very badly, because in those days the Japanese aren't the superb technicians that they are nowadays. And they have printed very badly one guilder or $1 or 1 cent, whatever it might be, on it. And this is the money. Now, this money was accepted within the camp, but of course the people outside, the farmers and so on, the suppliers, never believed that the Allies had made the announcement, the Allies, that they would pay one for one on this money. But they never believed they would, and of course inflation became quite rampant. And so within the camp, most camps, when razor blades ran out, since it was essential that you had to shave, because the Japanese insisted on it, they wouldn't allow beards and they wouldn't allow long hair, so you had to have a camp barber. And the camp barber used to charge 1 cent for a shave or anything. But the 1 cent was on exactly the right size for a cigarette. So he used to sell them for 2 cents. So in other words, you could sell a 1 cent piece for 2 cents, because it was more valuable as paper than it was as money. I suggest when you reach that stage with pounds, inflation is really here.
Not even worth the paper it's printed on.
Yeah, exactly.
Coming back to this question of entertainment, did you ever organise, as they did in the German camps, entertainment such as concerts, plays, or singing?
Yes, in Java, particularly, we were very good. We had we were much more organised than there was possible, because I suppose there was a Dutch settlement all round, to get in scripts of plays, and we had quite a thriving entertainment set up there, and we had debates, we had brain trusts, so there was very good entertainment. And also, and this was Van der Post's greatest thing about him, that he produced for the forest, he started what one can only call now an open university, that he got all the people who were graduates there to give lectures to people who wanted to in a particular area, and indeed produce certificates at the end if they felt they'd reached, not a degree standard, obviously, but had reached a certain standard.
So, did he organise examinations?
Yes, indeed. Yes, they were, what good they were, I don't know afterwards, but they were very good for people who wanted to learn foreign languages, for instance, because you could learn Dutch if you wanted to, and there were several others. And there were a few professional teachers around, of course, as well. So that was excellent, but it didn't happen in the lesser camps in terms of numbers and well organised. So in Sumatra, we did have a few concerts, but they were very crude compared with the other place. But also, of course, we were now getting on, and when you got into the second year, third year, life had stopped being fun, and life was much tougher in a way.
Did you find that the Japanese treatment of you varied according to how the war went?
No, not particularly. Not particularly, which is quite surprising, till very near the end, but not all the way through. They, in fact, they rarely talked about the war as such. One of the things that I felt, in a sense, one felt certain, not exactly pity, but certainly felt some understanding of the Japanese guard attitude, was very much that they were deliberately brutalised. It was part of their training to brutalise them. And I think in terms of beatings, I don't believe I ever saw, I certainly was never hit, or I don't think I ever saw anybody else hit quite as badly as I saw Japanese officers hit their own people. And also, you see, those, you know, I told you about those two sergeants, Hosh and Hock. I remember one of them telling us that he actually had been in the army something like 30 years, and he hadn't been home once, hadn't had any leave at that time, going home leave. And he'd spent years and years, as most of them had, in China, where, again, their training had part of it was to kill and rape and burn, you know. And so, therefore, they were genuinely brutalised, and they, in a sense, it wasn't necessarily cruelty. This was part of being in the army. And so therefore, they really couldn't understand any other sort of treatment. And you know, when we tried to explain to them English punishments, like pack drill and so on, they found this quite unbelievable. You know, they thought this was very cruel. And they always boast that there's no such thing as a military prison in Japan. And of course there wouldn't be, because then everything was done on the spot by sheer brutality. But I suppose it's just a different culture, different ways.
Was there ever any attempt by the POWs to secure reliable information as to the war's progress, apart from putting two and two together about from Japanese propaganda sheets?
Yes, I think every camp, one of the extraordinary things about prisoners of war, I understand the same in Germany as well, that whenever you get a group of people together like that, it always seems to be possible to make a wireless set out of old tins and bits of wire or something. How they did, I do not know. But there were, in every camp I was in, there were some radios which operated.
And did you know the people who were running the radios?
I was quite well in on those things, but not, everybody didn't. That wasn't general knowledge. And it was also always kept so that a lot of stupid stuff was always mixed in with it.
How do you mean?
Well, so that if rumour got back to the guards, that they would say, oh, you know, just made up. It would be considered rather silly just to put out only the truth. But there were ways and means of knowing what was true and what was false.
Where was the radio hidden?
Oh, well, that was different in different places, but it was usually something which was easily taken to pieces and put reassembled. But we did have certain things of our own, and mind you, it was very little, but and I can't remember any inspections. You know, the sort of thing which they talk about in German prison of war camps, I really don't remember that happening. It never happened, as far as I'm concerned. I was never inspected. So, as far as I know, nobody ever thought about this as being a possibility.
So, in Japanese camps, they didn't have the organised system of German spying on the POWs?
Not anywhere where I was. But then I don't think they had that sort of concern in some ways. I mean, I don't say they were as brutal as the Germans in concentration camps, where the policy was to kill us. I think it was the policy, as far as I could see, in our places, were that it didn't matter if we died. If you stayed alive, you stayed alive, fair enough. But if you died, you died. And one thing that they were always very strict about, and they made a huge rules about it, were that if anybody escaped, everybody else would be killed. Now, whether that would have happened or not, I don't know, because nobody ever did escape. But what they did do, and which led to quite a lot of trouble in various places, is that they were so confident of this that the guarding of the camp was very primitive, to put, say the least. I mean, we, in fact, put the clamp up, put the wire up ourselves, which we always says to keep undesirable people out rather than keep us in. And the guards used to normally patrol till about midnight, and at midnight they'd all go and get their heads down and go to sleep. So it was quite easy to break out, and indeed and lots of people did break out. But not to escape, because first of all, escape, but where do you escape to? And it would mean certain death without any medicine or anything else. And also, of course, on the whole, the natives were hostile. But they weren't hostile if you, to what we used to call traders, that people would go out with a lot of stuff which other people would give them, like shirts and any old odds and ends, sell them at a for food or money and so on, and come back. So in fact, when there were cases, and that in some times there were, of people being caught, they were almost always being caught breaking in rather than breaking out. And so though they would be very severely punished, it didn't count as an escape.
Why were the native population hostile?
Oh, I always thought at the beginning was the fact that It was, after all, we were European and the Japanese were Asiatic, and it was all part of what they called the co-prosperity sphere. And I, for one, from what I could see in the short space of time I was there before the surrenders started taking place, I really wouldn't blame them, because I have no time at all for the English internees who were, or the English people who were there beforehand. The Tuans is equivalent to the Saabs, and also the Dutch planters and so on. But I think the Japanese, in their terms then, just as they say so now, made a terrible mistake that they treated the native populations worse than we ever did. I mean, in snob value as well as anything else. For instance, if you're, you know, any native, that applies to Sumatra or Java or Singapore, that if Japanese walk on the pavement, the others would all have to go into the road, you know, till he'd walk through it. So it wasn't very sensible behaviour on their part if they wanted it to last. And then the British did a very good thing, in fact, in honouring all the money, so that anybody who had Japanese money, in fact, got the full amount. That way, I think a lot of the money which English companies had invested in Malaya was safeguarded.
Other people have told me, who were prisoners of war, of kind of pilfering exploits which they got up to. Was there anything of that?
From the Japanese?
Well, from anywhere that they could.
No, well, I was always in the places I was, where one of the interesting things to look back on are sort of the social codes which seem to be essential to any society if it's going to survive. And one of the unwritten laws, and yet, as far as I could see, was absolutely sacred. I never came across a case of it being broken, was the sanctity of property. In fact, I never heard of any pilfering or stealing from anybody else, because, you know, your possessions were so few, but it was a question of life or death, and you had no way of locking anything up. It was always out, so anybody could steal anything. I never heard of anything ever being stolen.
No, I should say that they were telling
you could from the Japanese, yes, where it was possible. But of course, it was brave, you know. It's a question of the chances, because if you were out somewhere where there was the possibility of having stuff, you had to bring it in, and you didn't wear very much, of course, so there weren't very many hiding places. It was really a question of what sort of mood the guard were in. You see, sometimes the guard would let you in without any inspection at all. And on other cases, they would decide to keep you searched for a long time. So it was as chancy as that. So you really had to take a chance. Yes, and one of the things, though, which I think was quite interesting, because it sort of applied to the Japanese psychology rather well, was the main job we had in Sumatra, which was building an airfield. And this airfield actually never got built, but it was a very primitive way we did it. We had sort of people hacking down the earth at one stage, and then shovelers to put it into baskets, and the basket carriers to take it across and dump it. And as it got bigger, and we actually got rails and little tip trucks to take it. Now, they worked out how much earth per man we had to shift. And then there was a team, so you multiplied it, say, by 10, if there were 10 in the team. And before work started in the morning, they'd hammer in at the top of the tip where you had to go before the day's work finished. Well, we quickly sort of tumbled to that, and then went away. We'd have people up there bringing it in a foot or two, sometimes a yard, because we could get away with it, as we learned, because of the Japanese face business, which was very, very powerful. That wasn't something that you just read about or hear about in films. The loss of face was really terribly important. And if a Japanese turned round and nothing was happening, that would be such a loss of face that they wouldn't do it. So we knew that once they were in and once they were walking away, they would never stop and turn round and try and catch us, I said. Yet they must have known something from, because once a month, I think it was once a month anyway, they would have sort of some check on how far we should have got, and of course we never got that far. And they used to start a terrific blitz, as we used to call it, to try and get us at it, but which would work for a little while. But they knew we were doing this because they used to do all sorts of complicated things. For instance, if there was the stick was there and a little bush there, the chap would come down with a tape measure and measure that. But then we'd move the bush as well, which is quite easy. But so they never won. We always won at this. Until one of the quite amusing things that happened there was on one occasion that they brought in a lot of prisoners, criminal prisoners, who presumably they're Sumatrans, and they must have been, should have been hard cases because they're all in irons and so on, but they seemed friendly enough. Anyway, they worked by the side of us. And of course, they saw us doing this, and this nearly ruined it for us because they thought this was the funniest thing in the world. They were rolling around in laughter. But instead of them doing it nice and sensibly, because we always did a bit, they were bringing it right into the start, so they didn't do any work at all. And of course, we started to get further back than them and finished, they were all taken away. But they sort of rather spoiled it for a time. But on the whole, we never did what they wanted to. And as far as I could see, that airfield really never got finished. Certainly it was never operational, anyway.
You mentioned the Japanese threat to have people executed if there are any escapes. Yeah. But did the Japanese ever attempt to make you give parole?
No. I think they were pretty safe bet, because there really was nowhere to escape to. So if we'd have been on the mainland, that might have been a different story. I don't know what happened in Rangoon. You probably have had people from there. But being on islands, there was nothing, there was no possible way of escape. Nothing.
Did you, during the period you were a POW, have any contact with home?
Yes, I had a few cards, a few letters. We were allowed to send some cards. I can't remember exactly how many. More or less like telegrams. We were allowed 12 words, I think it was, and you weren't allowed to date it and weren't allowed to say where you were, but you just could say you're all right or something. Then we were allowed letters back. The letters, as far as I could make out, weren't censored. I think that came in, but I don't know if there's very much to say, to censor. I doubt if they had anybody who could read English well enough to be able to censor, anyway.
Did the letters just contain personal material on news of the war, or what?
Well, to us?
Mm.
Well, in my case, they were just letters about family things, actually. There's nothing secret in it because, again, I don't think the people at home realised exactly how cut off we were. So, yes, we did have letters. It took a long time, mind you. The first letters I got, we were already in Sumatra, so that means at least a couple of years to get the first letters through. Then we got sort of two or three lots. So we... altogether, I think I had about three or four letters. And we also had one Red Cross. But it wasn't one per man, it was a certain number which we could divide up.
This was a parcel, was it?
Parcel, yeah. But
At what stage did you receive that?
Well, that was also around Christmas, probably 44, and I can't be absolutely sure about that.
Can you tell me how you came to be released?
Yes, we moved from Sumatra down onto a ship again. Now, this was a very bad period for me. I suspect it was for many else, because while I was up in Sumatra, I didn't feel that bad. When we were moved, the effort of actually moving, and probably the psychological disturbance of moving, I found, A, I became depressed, and B, I felt pretty ill. And I think this was pretty true, because when we got on the ship, now this time it was a similar sort of ship to the one we'd come there, but we were deck cargo. In other words, we were our stuff was dumped down below, but we remained on deck all the time. Now, the difference here was very marked. A pity we haven't got film of both, because where I said before, the absolute horrific conditions produced humour and a camaraderie, up here, where there was hostility and anger and absolute ferocity. I mean, this is the one time when we could have led to murder if we'd have had weapons. And over the smallest, stupidest thing, that's my bit of deck, what do you do on my bit of deck during the day? And it would finish up with feeble sort of fisticuffs, but chiefly verbal aggression, which led to a lot of nastiness. And then what made the journey worse, that it was fairly unsafe then, because a lot of American submarines around. This is in early 45, March or April 45, rather. So it's the Americans were well on the way. And they wouldn't sail at night. At night the ship was stopped because so it shouldn't give any phosphorescent lighting for submarines. And therefore it became a much longer journey than it need have. But it was a very, very unpleasant journey from the point of view of everybody hating each other. Most people found their legs had started swelling from beriberi, because again there was very little food around. We were really rather pleased to get to Singapore. And then we moved into Changi at Singapore. Now, Changi was the most organised of all the camps, because it had been going right from the start. They'd had some sort of big shots there. But I was not actually in the prison itself. I was in the lots of huts outside. I was in one of the huts. There I had, strangely enough, the most traumatic experience of the whole war, as far as I personally was concerned, because they had a well-organized barber shop, for instance. Oh, do you want? I went there to be barbered, and unfortunately for me, they had a full-scale mirror. And this was the first time for 3 years or so that I'd seen myself. Because it's a strange thing. It's hard to imagine that you can go that length of time without ever seeing your own face, let alone your own body. Now, I'd seen everybody else with all their ribs showing, but suddenly seeing it in myself, I went into sort of a catatonic shock. I was standing there for a long time till somebody, one of my friends, came and sort of led me away. And I felt myself going downhill pretty rapidly after this.
Was this in your morale?
Well, both morale and physically, because the two things were so closely linked. I started losing weight, if you think that's possible. I'm thoroughly miserable, and it became even more miserable when I met up with a very good friend of mine whom we missed, you know, I told you, because of the hospital in the first instance. And he was in this camp, and it was very nice meeting him again, but he had to have a hernia operation. It was fairly serious. And they could do operations there because they had a hospital and so on. But he was in a ward which was upstairs, one flight of stairs. And I tried to go and see him, and I couldn't walk up these stairs. And this absolutely depressed me intensely because I just didn't have enough strength in